Thank you very much, and good morning, everyone. My talk this morning is on problems protecting healthcare workers from exposure to H1N1 and Ebola. Why is the infection control community in charge instead of OSHA and NIOSH, and then what can we do about it? Here's the obligatory disclosure statement. I have no relationships in the last 12 months or in my entire life, for that matter. So where does our federal government's occupational safety and health expertise reside? It resides with OSHA, which is in the Labor Department, and as you know, they develop and enforce standards, and when they don't have standards, they issue guidelines for protecting workers' safety and health. The other federal government agency with expertise is NIOSH, which is part of CDC, within CDC, and as you know, this is they do research, they develop guidelines also, and they advise OSHA. So this, we all know this, but this sort of sets the stage here for this discussion. So are healthcare workers covered by OSHA? Sure, they're covered. If healthcare workers are in the private sector, they're covered by the Occupational Safety and Health Act. In those states with state plans, the healthcare workers are also covered in the public sector. And for healthcare workers, where there are applicable OSHA standards, those are mandatory, like bloodborne pathogens, HAZCOM. If healthcare workers use respirators, the OSHA respiratory protection standard applies as well. So, you know, they're covered. But there's a problem here with infectious diseases, and there's no existing federal OSHA comprehensive infectious disease standard. There's only one state, and that's California, that has a standard. And this creates and has created a huge problem. So, who's in charge of protecting healthcare workers from infectious diseases? Well, as you might think, OSHA and NIOSH would be the lead agencies. They're really not. It's really CDC and the elements of CDC that deal with infection control, not NIOSH. And the infection control community and the trade associations in infection control, they're in charge, and they've been in charge for decades on what healthcare workers, what the protections for healthcare workers should be when they're treating, providing care to patients who are infected with infectious diseases. So CDC and its Infection Control Advisory Committee, its federal advisory committee, not OSHA and NIOSH, are the ones that are responsible for issuing guidelines for healthcare workers in infection control situations with patients. And it puts healthcare workers at risk from infectious agents. The infection control community is really concerned with taking care of patients, but they've also assumed the responsibility, improperly in my view, for also the protections for healthcare workers who take care of those infected patients, and they don't have the expertise to do that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that this morning. So let's take a look at the first example that makes the point, or at least attempts to make the point, with Ebola, the recent occurrence with Ebola. In 2014. So here are the facts in the CDC perspective. We have an infectious disease that has a very high case fatality rate, you know, 70%, for example, which is really quite high. This was a nasty bug. There's no vaccine, and it spread primarily or largely by contact with body fluids. The CDC also said, well, there might be some droplet spread, but there's no airborne transmission. In other words, it's not a particularly respiratory hazard. And in fact, Tom Frieden once infamously said, there's zero risk of getting airborne transmission of Ebola. And the CDC's perspective also was that with Ebola, any hospital in the U.S. could handle an Ebola patient, and they could adequately protect healthcare workers who were taking care of patients infected with Ebola. So that's where we start. If you go back before the recent events in 2014, they had some 2007 CDC healthcare worker Ebola PPE recommendations. And this is our starting point. Single gloves, a gown either fluid resistant or impermeable, surgical masks, goggles or face shields. You could use an N95 or higher for aerosol generating procedures if you want. And then they have this strange language in the final stages of a patient's course as they're about to die or they get worse. You may use double gloves, leg and shoe coverings. So what are the problems with this if this is primarily a contact disease? You have exposed skin, you have single gloves, you have no head cover. There is nothing in these guidelines about donning and doffing procedures. There was no buddy system. No training was emphasized. That's our starting point. And again, these are from the infection control folks, not from occupational safety and health expertise. So let's move forward to August and September of 2014. The healthcare worker Ebola PPE guidance, it kept changing from day to day, but basically in this time frame, it recommended the same PPE as the 2007 Ebola recommendations. Now they have some limited instructions on donning and doffing, but we really have the same problems as we had in 2007. Single gloves, exposed skin, no head cover, et cetera, et cetera. These recommendations were far less protective than the Doctors Without Borders were using in West Africa. So now we moved to October of 2014. Two nurses in Dallas get infected. And thankfully, neither one of them died as a result of their infection. So now the CDC is scrambling to revise its guidelines. And mind you, that while the infection control folks within CDC were in control of the guidelines, they're sharing these with OSHA and NIOSH, and they're getting some feedback, but they're kind of ignoring what they have to say, and that's always been the case. But now they're scrambling. And pretty much they blame the nurses for getting infected. But now they change the guidelines. They have an N95 or a PAPR, full body coverage, double gloving, detailed donning and doffing procedures, using trained observers, et cetera, et cetera. A big emphasis on training. This is where they should have been at the very beginning, not at the end when they're in a crisis. So OSHA and NIOSH expertise was largely ignored. Some people might argue that ignored is a little bit too strong of a term. I don't happen to think so. They were certainly minimized. Those agencies, OSHA and NIOSH, have decades of expertise dealing with worker protection for these kinds of issues with Ebola. For example, all you have to do is look at the hazardous waste rigs, asbestos lead. The expertise there, had they been in charge, OSHA and NIOSH, would have been vastly different than what you're getting from the infection control community. Skin contact, if skin contact is a problem, you need full body coverage. You can't have exposed skin. The hazardous waste regulations, asbestos, et cetera, donning and doffing and observation, this is a critical element to protect workers. Whether inhalation risks or the likelihood of inhalation as being the route of exposure, use respirators, and that worker training is a critical element. All of this expertise was largely ignored, and it put healthcare workers at significant risk. So that's Ebola. Another example is back in 2009 is the H1N1 pandemic and respiratory protection for healthcare workers. And again, let's just review the CDC infection control community's recommendations on seasonal influenza, which is sort of the baseline here for protecting healthcare workers. These folks believe that droplet transmission is the primary route of exposure, maybe some contact. No or little airborne transmission, so that by and large, surgical masks are appropriate for healthcare workers to use. Respirators are generally not necessary, although you should use caution with the aerosol procedures. Healthcare workers should wear N95s. And that's the current seasonal influenza recommendations for healthcare worker PPE. And basically, the infection control community largely ignores the substantial evidence of airborne transmission of influenza. So, let's look at the pandemic flu. The initial phase of the H1N1 pandemic, CDC recommendations were appropriate, very appropriate. They recommended that healthcare workers wear an N95 whenever they entered a patient room of those that are confirmed, suspected, or probable H1N1 infected. And the rationale, there was a lot of rationale, but a couple items, is that the transmission characteristics were unknown at that time, there was no vaccine available, and the severity of the disease was unclear. So reluctantly, the infection control community, sort of grousing, but realized that, okay, at the very beginning that was fine, but after a couple of months of infection in the U.S., the infection control organization started applying significant political pressure on CDC and Health and Human Services. And they said, look, we should treat H1N1 like seasonal flu. Droplet transmission is the route of exposure we should be concerned about. Healthcare workers should use surgical masks. And okay, well, maybe we'll sort of hedge our bets a little bit here and use respirators for aerosol generating procedures. And these are the organizations that, professional organizations representing the infection control community that weighed in significantly on these particular issues. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, you know, OSHA and NIOSH was trying to, prepare CDC for this and supporting maintaining the existing guidance despite the political pressure. So what does CDC do in response to this political pressure? They turn to its Federal Advisory Committee on Infection Control, which is HICPAC, or the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee. And this is a committee that provides advice on protecting patients, which is the sphere of infection control, but also healthcare workers. And so you say, well, do they have any occupational safety and health expertise to really examine these issues fully? If you look at the existing roster of HICPAC, there are 14 public members, mostly are MDs. They work for hospitals, medical schools, and they're in charge of infection control or infectious disease. There's essentially no occupational safety and health expertise of the 14 public members that are on HICPAC. There's no one for the schools of public health. There's no one within an industrial hygiene, etc. Also, part of the HICPAC is some non-voting federal representatives. There are six. Those are federal representatives that deal with infectious disease and patient care. No one from NIOSH or OSHA is a federal representative on HICPAC. And then you look at, there's non-voting liaison representatives, and there's 21 organizations currently. Only one, and that's ACOM, the OCDOCS, can make a claim that they have expertise in occupational safety and health. So of over 41 members, only one representative could legitimately claim to have substantial occupational safety and health expertise. There's no one from AIHA, the occupational health section of APHA. There's no one for the occupational health nurses. There's no ASSE representative, et cetera. So the emperor has no clothes in terms of occupational safety and health expertise. So they turn to the advisory committee, and so we raised, we being in the labor movement, raised a lot of hell about this development. HICPAC decided that they would create a working group. And so they invited three union reps and they put four HICPAC members. So you already know that it's a setup here. But we decided that we would participate because it would look bad if we didn't participate. So to look at to address this respiratory protection recommendations that the infection control community was trying to push CDC to go to. And so at the first meeting, we had provided all of the HICPAC members on this work group a substantial body of industrial hygiene and other occupational safety and health published data. We recommended that that three experts provide some input to this working group, experts from the occupational safety and health community. It became clear that HCPAC had no interest in doing this. They weren't interested in looking at the evidence. They weren't interested in listening to the expertise of people who were true experts in occupational safety and health. And after the first meeting, all the labor representatives resigned. I was on the committee, and we had two other people, one from SEIU and another from AFSCME. So we resigned. But nevertheless, the working group, now only four HCPAC members, carried on, and they said, well, there's evidence for droplet and airborne transmission, but we don't know the relative contribution of either route. So, as a result, we'll only protect workers from one route, which is droplet transmission, except for aerosol-generating procedures. So this is sort of, this is in line with what the infection control trade associations were wanting. With the occupational safety and health community protect healthcare workers from only one route of exposure? No, I don't think so. Never. So that's where that was the advice that CDC was getting, and OSHA was panicked at this point. So they decided, and with CDC, that they would bankroll Institute of Medicine review of respiratory protection and influenza. And now you have, for the first time, a real balanced committee. I was on that committee. There was expertise in industrial hygiene, respiratory protection, epidemiology, influenza transmission, infection control, occupational health nursing. This is clearly a group of experts with a wide range of expertise to address this issue. And we reviewed all of the evidence, not just some of the evidence. And the IOM report concluded that healthcare workers in close contact with infected patients with H1N1 should wear N95 respirators, and the CDC maintained their original guidance on H1N1. So you have the HCPAC with their recommendation and the IOM, and of course this now goes to the White House, and the White House makes the determination. And the White House made the determination that, yeah, we respect the IOM process, we respect IOM reports and conclusions, we're going to go with that. But it took, that was the kind of pressure that was being applied in this situation. And if we had had the occupational safety and health expertise of OSHA and NIOSH in charge to begin with, we wouldn't have found ourselves in this situation. So so they adopted, the CDC stayed with the guidance, but the infection control folks didn't stop. And they began to put political pressure on President Obama. They said, modify the CDC guidance, use surgical masks, not respirators, and institute an immediate moratorium to stop OSHA from enforcing its respiratory protection requirements for the use of N95s. So they wanted OSHA to not enforce their own regulations. So why does CDC ignore OSHA and NIOSH expertise? Some of it's arrogance. They think that OSHA and NIOSH have expertise in manufacturing and construction, but that the infection control folks and CDC, they have expertise in healthcare, and that includes protecting healthcare workers. Another part of it is maintaining control and power. They've been in control of this for 40 years. They're not going to give up that control and power easily. Also, they issue guidelines and not standards. This is where the absence of an OSHA standard applies. So little is mandatory. Employers can do whatever they want, and there was numerous examples of this during the H1N1 where state health departments, local health departments, and employers just ignored the CDC recommendations and did whatever they want, adopted some of them, or some parts of them, sometimes ignored them altogether. And another thing is that if they recommend respirators, the OSHA respirator standard must be followed, and a lot of employers, it's not easy to run to maintain a compliant respirator standard with the OSHA, and that's been a problem. So how do we put NIOSH and OSHA back in control in the situation? Legislative approach, currently OSHA has all of the legislative authority it needs, and what do you think the likelihood of getting anything positive back done in this Congress? That's not going to happen. More science and data, sure, more science and data is useful, but it's necessary but not sufficient. Establishing an OSHA infectious disease standard, I think, will change the dynamics drastically. This is now a situation where OSHA can assert its legal authority. But I think the real solution to this is a political and administrative action. This is where OSHA, HHS, and DOL agree that for protecting healthcare workers from infectious diseases, OSHA and NIOSH should be the lead agencies on healthcare worker protection, and CDC and the infection control community will provide advice and consultation and flip the roles here and put it back where it needs to be. And in order to do this political action, political support from the trade union movement, APHA, the occupational safety and health community will be necessary. Thank you very much.
Great. So we have about 15 minutes for questions. If you could stand up, state your name, and identify your affiliation, that would be great.
So my name is Dorothy Wakor. I'm the guilty party that Dee mentioned. And I just want to ask Dee what she thinks of, and others, what she thinks of what we found. But I went looking for the data sheet for Cyrus that Chevron put out on the same day for a number of countries. And I'm just quoting from the letter that I read. The GHS classification list for China includes only 4 of the 9 GHS categories of the most recent U.S. one, 4 of the 14 on the Japanese one, and 4 of the 10 on the Korean one. And as a consequence, the labels are different in China, and the ones saying styrene is toxic is missing. So the U.S. has 10 GHS categories on this styrene data sheet. It does not include reproductive toxicity and cancer, which are 2 of 14 on the Japanese one. So this is consistent with the weight of evidence approach.
Is there an Anthony want me to get it? I mean, let's make it the GHS is a document. The European Union has this whole REACH thing going on and all this other thing, and there are countries who are relying on sources. There's nothing to stop OSHA from relying on sources or anything else. We went into rulemaking in California, we were told by OSHA, you cannot touch a tender bed. We will not give you permission to touch a tender bed. And that limited what we could do. And once you allow tender bed in weight of evidence, you're lucky you've got 10. If you looked up to the Styrene Industry Research Council, you could have gotten 2. Flammable.
That's pretty much what happened in China. The other thing I just wanted to say, one of the reasons this fight was so important and meant a whole lot to me is I'm Canadian. And one of the consequences of OSHA adopting this was that Davis and others at OSHA signed an agreement with the Canadian government to harmonize the right to know rules here with the right to know rules in Canada that we've had since 1988. And frankly, ours is better. We have trade secret rules that require registration. We have way lower disclosure limits on cutoffs on a number of things. And many of those are gone now because the Canadian government we had, fortunately we overthrew it a few weeks ago, the Canadian government we had just wanted to go along with the business agenda. And that was the least amount of information possible. So workers in Canada have paid a huge price for what OSHA did in the United States. Anyway, don't get me started. Thank you very much.
I'm Laura Stock from LOHC, and I just felt like I needed to say Beach thanked a bunch of people when she ended her presentation. But I want to specifically, really, it's important that everybody knows the incredible role that Beach played in fighting and pushing back with the GHS. It's on account of Beach's work that California has an egg for transmissible disease standards. I mean, really, you know, I don't like to say it's a one-person effort, but it felt that way.
Thank you.
work without fight allies, and that is really an important part of our strategy, and we lack that now, and things are not going to be as good in the future as they were in the past. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And Laura and Patty on the Standing Board have been a tremendous force for good in California. And there's still good that's going to come out of the Standing Board because we have a few really good members on the board. And I don't want to jeopardize their position. I do want to say this, this was a humongous effort. Once we figured out what GHS was and started putting out the alarm, because that's what happened, is that this thing, for whatever reason, went through on a federal level. And people put in some comments, but the federal register on it responded to comments, crappy. But when we started spreading the alarm and saying, hey, something's really wrong here, from all over the country, you know, Mark Catlin sent us videos and mobilized at CRU, the CNA, was represented by Kelly Green. They put in stuff, all the unions, but lots of health and safety people and lots of people who are involved. There's a lot of people here and knowing the people here who are involved in this, and it was really heartwarming to see everybody kind of get together and say, well, we're going to hang on to what we can. And we got criticized, and rightly so, for changes we didn't make to the federal GHS, and that was done in part because federal OSHA said you cannot go any further than this, despite our going whining and complaining to David, and we had problems with our regional ministers, so we were whining and complaining to David and Jordan, and they helped us some. I guess I'm not talking to say that either. But that despite their intention, and Christine Baker's backdoor meetings with chemical manufacturers in the other direction, we were limited by what we could do. And there is something that has to be. We need to reinvigorate the right to know. We take it for granted. Now people will think that because it's not on the label, it isn't on the label. People are going to say because it's not labeled as a carcinogen, since we have this whole wonderful GHS, it isn't a carcinogen. It doesn't cause reproductive harm. That's not true, and that is less true today than it was in 2011. And that, I think, is something that we go through. And you should look. I gave the link on those presentations, you know, to the webpage with the comments we received during our advisory process. There are some really smart people saying some really smart things to us, and we need to. I think this is a role HHA can play in reinvigorating the right to know.
Great. I think Celeste.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing about that. So around this exact time where the OSHA was moving forward in the GHS, this is the exact time that President Obama had the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and Cass Sunstein, and they specifically called out this great new OSHA reg that was going to be reducing all these burdens. You know, they had like a figure of, I mean, it was something like crazy, like $1 billion savings. And so that was the forces that were going on at the federal level as part of this anti-regulatory agenda.
Yes.
Yeah, on the continuing theme of the GHS stuff. So did I hear you correctly to say that the weight of evidence documentation that a manufacturer is supposed to go through isn't available for critique?
It doesn't have to be available for critique. In California, it does. In California, if they're not going to list something based on one positive study, they have to have it. But we don't have jurisdiction over any out-of-state manufacturer, unfortunately. I don't know why. That's something about the U.S. Constitution. But since the written weight of evidence is no longer required, it's kind of like discrimination law. But one of the things the union contract gives you is just cause discipline or just cause fire. They have to give a reason for doing that. If you don't have a union contract, they don't have to give a reason. They can just fire me, right? And so then it's up to me to prove discrimination. And so getting rid of the written requirement for the requirement for a written hazard evaluation then makes it be on OSHA or the worker to have to bear the burden of proof to show that they didn't do the weight of evidence rather than the lawyer actually. It's a pretty important shift. It's just like a line in a regulation. Mm-hmm. But so many things are.
I think this would be Leslie for Celeste. Can you talk about that, you know, with OSHA OSHA, when OSHA does rulemaking and OIG, you know, the whole delayed OIG process, and you were talking about, you know, costs and benefits, $1 million to $1 billion, and how we keep getting a larger, you know, it has to be over for, to be considered a significant rulemaking to be reviewed by OIG, it has to be over the threshold. But how that number keeps being the number that's thrown out there, and in reality, I mean, that's a total cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like business is facing $1 billion. Like, this is a nationwide, this is distributed among businesses.
Right.
Like, the false perception of what that number means, what it's written in the media number, of course, versus what that actually, the impact that actually would have on.
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. So it's when OSHA makes a calculation, they're estimating the cost. So it's like companies have to buy some new equipment, or what's the cost of doing training? And so they look at all the number of establishments affected, and the incremental cost for those establishments, and then they just add all that up. And so it's a $300 million cost. But you're right, I think, Becky, that when you look at something like the silica standard, and they cut out the medical surveillance trigger to save $146 million off the bottom line of that regulation, the rule itself for individual employer, OSHA estimated for a small employer, was going to be $550. So the number looks really big, but when you think of it in terms of the number of establishments affected and what they actually have to do, the number is very small.
Another question about the space and data sheet. Is there any compliance or enforcement or penalty on a manufacturer, chemical formulator, distributor for failing to put the correct information on an SDS? I mean, my personal view is that there should be criminal prosecution of the board of directors of the chemical manufacturer for failing to put something on there. I know that we don't have that mechanism. But is there any mechanism, because I see SDS sheets that don't contain information, that are not accurate, but I don't know, what's the...
I'm familiar with one particular case, it was Brush Wellman, some years back, it was doing the Bush, like in the 2008-09 period of time, OSHA issued a citation against Brush Wellman for an inadequate MSDS because it did not say that beryllium was a carcinogen. They said something like, there is scientific evidence that it might be a carcinogen, or something like that. So OSHA did issue a citation. I think that ultimately they were forced to change their MSDS.
And OSHA establishes when after the zillion blowout, for formaldehyde on both the FDS and the label, but also in California, we have sightings. We have sightings already. I'm sure that federal OSHA had two for missing ingredients under the old standard. I don't know what's happening.
Darcy, and I'm just going to say, federal OSHA actually has used the most recent Adcock stuff and gone after a company that did not use the weight of evidence to decide that EPA was. I think of reproductive toxins. So there's they were trying to say they weren't using the weight of evidence in the removal process.
Have they won?
I don't know. I've been following. I haven't seen it.
So just on Bob's point, there's a case Suzanne Maria and I'm through with fellowship. There's a case of the California Supreme Court right now on preemption of the state OSHA plan's ability and prosecutors in California ability to use a business and professions code section against businesses who do business violation of the law, under false advertising. That would be the section in California to prosecute and manufacture for leaving stuff up. But essentially what the company is doing in this case is using the preemption arguments and say, oh, well, that law was never approved by Fed OSHA as part of the same plan, so it's preempted by the entire Fed OSHA Act and will never be able to use again. So, the way these issues come into play and employers are very effective at the national level, they're getting the national manufacturers they're watching these issues naturally. They need to be watching them. So that's why I'm doing it.
Okay, one last question and then we'll have to end, unfortunately.
Pamela Bowles, this is Nate here. So, for Billy Tuggraff, I'm sure that there are new people, sorry. But NIOSH is under the CDC, correct? So, is there no jurisdictional leverage you want us there?
You know, see, I mean, they. Essentially, NIOSH vows to the edicts of CDC leadership. So, you know, they should kind of sit on NIOSH. They involve them behind the scenes, and they'll share documents and want NIOSH comments, and NIOSH will provide good comments, and CDC will pick and choose when it accepts, and oftentimes it accepts the little or nothing from NIOSH. And I know, you know, I get lots of off-the-record conversations with the NIOSH folks that are providing perspective to CDC on a level, and most of them were ignored. And so, you know, I think administratively, you know, whoever running CDC has a lot of control over what NIOSH can do, and I think that's why there has to be a political solution to at the level of HHS and DOL to resolve this problem and flip the relationship to the OSHA and NIOSH. Are the lead agencies, and of course they can get input from the Russian control community. That's important because that they're the ones that are calling the shots, and they're the ones that are putting together the framework.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's thank our presenters. Announcements as people are leaving. There's a section meeting tonight at 6:15 in 176B talking about ideas for sessions for next year to which all are invited. There is our sections award luncheon today. If you don't have a ticket, you're still welcome to come. Just bring your own lunch and join us. And then that's at 12:30 to 2. It's in McCormick Place West, 190A. There's also the dance party tonight from 8:30 to midnight at Vice District Brewing, and that benefits our scholarship fund, and that is from, again, 8:30 to midnight. So hope to see you at one or all of those.
Thank you so much.